The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host, Eric Peabody. Tonight, we have a story from J.R. Hamintaschen, who we featured earlier this season with his story, Sorrow Has Its Natural End. Good old J.R. has impressed us here at Horror Hill with a writing style that is both lyrical and eviscerating. Along those lines, tonight's story is titled Vernichtungsschmerz, which means The Pain of Annihilation in English. Julia is a high schooler in a posh area of New York State. She and her friends, Venice, Lynn, and Claire, are all intelligent teens, having fun and planning their futures. Around this seemingly idyllic life, Julia has started having strange dreams, dreams in which an entity appears in different forms, all of which are terrifying. This entity talks to Julia and presents her with an opportunity that is both beyond anything she could imagine and also horrifying in its implications. This entity doesn't coerce Julia, but as it continues to appear in her dreams time after time, she finds herself becoming intrigued with its proposal. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy ad-free versions of this and hundreds of tales from our audio archives dating back to 2012, visit chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today and get instant access. Did I mention they're ad-free? Thank you for your support. And now, from author J.R. Hamintaschen, I give you Vernichtungsschmerz. Julia never remembered her dreams. At most, she'd come back with discrete images that couldn't be cobbled together into a narrative whole. Images that would rebound within her memory banks for, at most, several hours, then dissipate to wherever faded memories went. Then, at some point, her attempt to recall them would give way to speculation and conjecture. She was in a dream now, she knew. She was gently making her way down an azure blue river. Her aunt and her friend Venice were with her, which was weird. Why not her mother? She found herself questioning the premise of this dream. Why Venice? Was Venice her best friend? Already, the fabric of the dream was tenuous, as she saw herself from the third-person perspective, alongside her aunt and Venice, noting to herself the incongruent angles of the river and the unrealistic color of the raft that carried them. When you became aware of a dream, that's when it would end. She felt the bobbing of gently moving water beneath her and looked down at the orangish wood. She was impressed with the granular level of detail in the wood, in the construction of the raft. She knew nothing about handiwork, but she could tell this raft was professionally constructed. She was impressed with herself, that she even had a frame of reference within her to recognize a well-crafted raft. She let her fingers drift in the water. She distinctly felt them submerge and instinctively tightened her bladder. Dreams of water meant you were going to pee the bed. She rubbed her fingers in the stream, convinced any minute she'd wake up with a warm, damp bed. Her aunt and Venice mouthed words, but what they said was a mystery. What? She thought, and wasn't sure if that thought made its way into the dream. Her aunt rocked back and forth. She wore black, which was typical of her. She didn't see Venice below the waist. It was definitely Venice, tall, gangly Venice, large equine mouth and facial features, curly black hair. The rendering was impressive. She made out the impressions of Venice's pronounced teeth and wondered if she had internalized Venice's insecure impression of herself. Venice spoke softly and indistinctly. Julia turned her head to see a large, humanoid creature stand up beside her. It was pale green, long, lean, and well-proportioned. It was gilled and scaled. 5 hook-shaped claws on each hand, blubbery webbing connecting each claw to the other. Its face was indistinct, like everything else, except its mouth seemed too far back, sprung back almost, but claws forward, as if its claws were the antenna it used to navigate the world. Julia, I'm here to help you. Come with me. I'm here to help you. The impression of shaking her head. Come with me, Julia. Come with me. The webbing of its claws split, and new, scythe-like claws emerged continuously, a conveyor belt of sharp angles and scaly blubber. She shook her head, whether in the dream or in real life, she didn't know. Venice and her aunt were gone. I do not know what your mind is making me look like to you. I apologize if I appear frightening to you. Its breath, or perhaps just its presence, was sulfurous, redolent of damp disease. Her dream jump cut to a memory of when she opened what she thought was an empty drawer at her aunt's house and found the corpse of a mouse in a sticky trap, its bottom still plump but covered in its own musty droppings, its upper half feeble and emaciated, a hint of pink color for guts. That smell, when she first opened the drawer and realized what she was looking at, that's what this reminded her of. She was back to her dream reality, still on a moving raft, but with just isolated details, nothing that provided a larger impression of her environment, as if her brain didn't have the processing power to create a coherent background. When she took her focus off something, it disappeared. I don't look like anything. I don't smell like anything. I don't sound like anything. That's odd, she thought mildly. She liked the sound of its voice, masculine, but in a non-threatening way. Everything you perceive, that's just your brain creating a projection that it wants you to believe is true. But it's not true. I don't look like what you are seeing. The creature reached its arms out, palms up, claws up, long as rakes. so long that they didn't make anatomical sense. How could a creature that lives in the water possibly have claws the size of rakes? I am here to help you. I will not make you do anything. I will give you a choice, as much as a choice is possible in your reality. You did not choose any of your urges, preferences, or limitations. You did not even choose to be in this sleep state. I am here to tell you that I offer you a painless exit out of existence. The fetid smell had become overpowering. There was the heavy heat of unwashed body, bacterial buildup. The reeking scene jaundiced all the creature's words, smothered all else. The tinge of genuine sympathy she detected now gone, curdled beneath her base revulsion. Of course, your brain wants you to survive and reproduce. That is why you feel pain when you get hurt, to let you know that there's trouble, to get you to avoid those situations so you can survive and reproduce. Your brain, your nerves, your senses, they don't want you to listen, for I do bring death. I bring you the escape from pain, from fear. Your brain will let you feel the pain of disease, of cancer, of decay. But I am here to tell you something else, something your own body, your own mind, will never reveal to you. In your reality, there is no such thing as a painless death. When you die, your brain reacts to get you out of whatever situation is causing your death. To your brain, it is like your finger is in boiling water. It sends the signal to tell you to remove it. But now imagine your entire body is in boiling water and there's no hope of escape. That's what death is. It's the feeling of your own system in pain, cannibalizing itself. All that pain, you feel it. Time is subjective. The pain lasts forever. It swallows everything you ever did and every memory you ever had. All life ends in a tide of pain, and as your mind controls your perception of time, it's a never-ending tide. The soaring, uplifting chug of Bear versus Sharks Ma Jolie flooded her brain space. The dream snapped, and she was awake. It was the dead of night. All was still. Ma Jolie was her favorite song, and she'd adopted the opening chord progression as her morning alarm. She checked her phone. It hadn't gone off. She checked the time. 4:27 a.m. The night was long and still. Try as she might, she was unable to fall back asleep. Man, Julia said when her three best friends were all seated around the lunchroom table the following day. I used to be jealous of people who could remember their dreams. Not anymore. I had the most fucked up dream last night. Claire, Venice, and Lynn didn't jump immediately at the bait, like Julia had hoped. They were still adjusting themselves, putting their book bags under the seat, and readying their trays around the table in the outside courtyard. It was chilly outside, but they had warm down jackets and had braved the cold to at least sit outside and get peace and quiet from the loud, obnoxious cafeteria and the table-spanning, shouted conversations. They were all 16 and halfway through their junior years at Lakewood High School in Shrub Oak, New York, a middle-class, undistinguished suburb about an hour north of Manhattan. All of them came from families who had uprooted themselves from New York City with hopes of securing themselves a piece of the suburban American dream, decisions made by New Yorkers who lived their formative years in the 1970s and 1980s, when New York City was a metonym for urban disorder. Now, of course, New York City was a locus point of gentrification, and the suburbs were steadily and rapidly absorbing the fallout of the recession. Each year, it seemed there were less and less places to go. The odd, inverse relationship of more people, yet more shuttered businesses. The local Jefferson Valley Mall had just, for example, been placed on the Dying Mall's website. All four of them resented losing their New York City birthright, and for what? The drabness of the suburbs with none of the supposed benefits. Suburbs weren't safer, if you thought about it. More teenagers die from car accidents than gunfire. Venice took the bait first. Venice was the tallest of the group, 6'1", with long, curly raven hair, a stud tongue ring and belly button ring, a toothy smile, and a subtly elongated facial bone structure that made her resemble a horse. Not really in a bad way. She was pretty and fit and equine in the same way as Julia Roberts. Out of the group, the boys were perhaps most interested in her. Some combination of her fit body, her big mouth, her erotic name, and the halo effects of her belly button and tongue rings, which created associations about body image and sexual proclivities that were entirely incidental. "So, what was it about?" Venice asked. "A long conversation with a monster about dying." "Sounds pretty cool to me." "Yeah," Lynn joined in. "Your plea for sympathy is hereby rejected. I am officially jealous. My dreams are always boring." That last point wasn't true, not recently, but she let the comment stand. Lynn was bundled especially warmly in a green, cozy-looking knit sweater, which was appropriate for her. She had big, clunky brown glasses, and the fact that they made her look geek chic sexy was purely adventitious. She was short, pert, and peppy, about 5'5", and a natural blue-eyed blonde, with a mane which she kept long and well-mannered. Under alternative circumstances, meaning if you knew nothing about her personality, one could easily imagine her as a cheerleader. Yet no one acted like that was true. Years later, classmates would reminisce about her and talk about how cute she was, and ponder how odd it was that it seemed like no one ever dated her. Instead of social climbing or dating, she applied that natural pep and go-getterism to doing well in school, fastidiously finishing tasks, getting OCD about her favorite musical genres, emo-core and upbeat pop-punk, and making sure her much younger sister got the proper exposure to books and culture.
"Yeah, sounds like a humble brag to me. What did the monster look like? Was it cool looking?"
That was Claire, in between bites of overcooked, droopy school pizza.
"I guess so. It smelled really badly. I was impressed, actually, that my mind could render something like that. I didn't get a good look at the background, though."
Claire was the only one of them who had a boyfriend, which wasn't what you'd expect. She was pleasant and innocuous, an affable wallflower given to bouts of social anxiety. As if form met function, she had a mousy look, with matted-looking brown hair, average height and average weight, and a curiously sedimentary, layered countenance, kind of rough and porous, with an atypical bone structure. She had a tendency to sniff her food before eating it, although she only did that in front of her close friends these days. She spoke with a slight lisp, which felt right, given the intangible curiosity of her face. To boys, she was a nice, pleasant presence, as she had that air of non-judgmental obtainability about her. That's perhaps what led to her being the only one with a boyfriend. Although, truth be told, the other girls weren't too concerned about having boyfriends. Claire's boyfriend, Isaac, fit in nicely to their group centrism, as he was 2 years older and busy with Westchester Community College and his side job doing light carpentry work for his father. Isaac, when he was around, was an unobtrusive presence, a nod of the head, a filled seat on the couch.
"I had a crazy dream too. I just can't even remember it. I just remember thinking it was crazy. It's weird because I've been reading a lot."
Claire pulled out a used paperback, Stormfront by Jim Butcher.
"It's cool. It's got a lot of monsters and supernatural stuff and wizards in it, so I'm disappointed I didn't have a great, vivid dream that I remembered. Usually when I read, my memory gets sharper. I'm jealous. You must be gifted."
"You sounded so cute,"
If you were a hamster, I'd just want to take you home, said Lynn.
Wizards.
She did her best approximation of how Claire lisped the word.
Thwithards.
Venice exaggerated it, using deposited saliva and her tongue ring to great effect.
I love it. How can you be reading that?
Venice looked at the paperback. Oh, I've been meaning to read that, actually. Heard it's good. But how you're reading that before Hitchhiker's Guide is a crime against the universe and a personal insult to me. Do you even still have it?
I'll get into it, I promise.
You have to make good on your promises. Your cute lisp can't save you forever. She's done pretty well with it for 16 years, Lynn deadpanned. She perfected it before she could even speak. Julia deadpanned back. They all took pleasure in teasing each other for lapses in logic, malapropisms, and the like. One time, Julia pronounced automaton as automaton, and Lynn had a field day.
I know. That's what makes it so effective. When you can master something before you even do it, that's the only way you can really be called a master. You can only be a master if you can perfect something before you can even do it.
An illogical but airtight quandary.
Airtight. Viciously airtight in its illogic, which makes it all the more effective.
They went on for a bit with this inspired nonsense. They could riff off each other all day. They had enough rapport, in-jokes, and meta-references for a Wikipedia entry. They talked and ate, with a couple callbacks to the lispy noises and the foolish mastery paradox. Julia ate the peanut butter sandwich and apple she brought from home and enjoyed the company. Julia found herself at the same lunch table under almost identical circumstances. She unwrapped her lunch, and again, it was a homemade sandwich. Same coarse brown wheat bread, same shiny red delicious apple. She unwrapped the sandwich out of the tinfoil and bit into it. It was chewier, smushier than usual, with an overpowering texture on one side and abrasive, crunchy pieces on the other. The fractious mismatch of textures made chewing difficult. She opened up her sandwich. It was, literally, peanuts and butter. Half of the bread was slicked heavy with dairy butter. The other half was a deposit of whole peanuts. How could this be possible? Under no circumstances does someone say, "Hey, I made a mistake. Instead of peanut butter, I used peanuts and butter." Under what sort of haze would someone have to be in to literally take out ill-fitting, cumbersome solid peanuts and tuck them into one side of the bread, and then slop on a gag-inducing amount of butter onto another side of bread and smush the two pieces together? She opened up the sandwich to show her friends as prima facie evidence that something was wrong. The thing spoke for itself. None of her friends seemed to notice or comment on it.
My dreams have been weird too, said Lynn.
Lynn was probably the sharpest of the four friends, so Julia was interested in what she had to say.
They are interesting, though. I'm interested in them and what they have to show me.
Julia hummed.
That's an even-keeled attitude to have, she thought.
She was speaking to Lynn without seeing her, she realized. She did her best to look at her, but couldn't conjure up a vision of what Lynn looked like. As if in consolation, a show of defeat, she associated her with a green, warm-looking sweater and tight black pants. Was Lynn wearing the same green shirt as yesterday?
No, she didn't really wear tight black pants, but they'd suit her in her subtle way.
That wasn't fair, she thought. They were sitting around the table, but no one else was eating. When she wasn't looking at Lynn, she seemed to disappear. No one was talking. Maybe James and his group of friends who shared the courtyard with them were doing something interesting and distracting. James' group and their group were cool with each other and sometimes met up, went to local music shows to see the same shitty local bands. She turned, and there was nothing behind her. Literally nothing. It was as if she had turned her head to witness a Nivea stain with the intensity of a supernova.
Her subconscious stirred slightly at the thought of a brief, frustrating fight with her mother. She'd said something mean and impatient toward her mother, more out of hunger pangs and frustration than anything else. But how did that make sense? The timing was all wrong. This was lunchtime. She was at school. Venice spoke while two hands emerged from her mouth, each hand pushing her jaws in opposite directions. Her longish face became even longer. Her chin descended at least an inch, and her mouth jutted forward, giving her a hook-like shovel face. She didn't scream or react hysterically, but her voice abruptly cut out. The upper part of her face bulged out narrowly, like the beak of a bird. The top of a figure emerged from her mouth as her body crumpled and broke off around her. "That's not right," Julia thought. Venice's body should be gore and viscera, blood everywhere, a horror show. Instead, the top half of a figure just stood upright through Venice's baleen mouth, unfolding and ascending upward into a standing position, like a seed rapidly germinating into a flower, rising from the flower pot that was Venice's impossibly solid and overstretched jaws. The figure fully emerged, and Venice bloodlessly broke off and tumbled away, like detritus thrown overboard on a moving ship. "This is another dream," the figure told her. It was silver and featureless, just the outline of a human shape. The dimensions didn't make sense, but it was bigger and vaster than she was. "You are dreaming. I'm not here to hurt you. I apologize for however I look to you if I frighten you. Your brain perceives me as a threat and will do whatever it can to make me seem threatening. Just as it comes so naturally to you to assign negative attributes to spiders or snakes, your body does the same with me. Just remember that the spider or snake is not evil. It just is. And your brain communicates what it needs to communicate to you to keep you living and procreating. Your brain, including the parasites that control it and the forces of natural evolution, does everything within its power to convince you to procreate and extend your genetic legacy. It does what it does. It's a program. I am here to offer you a reprieve from living and procreating. No living thing can ever know whether life has been worth living without first experiencing the sensation of dying. No one who has ever died can testify to the experience of dying. Left to your own devices, your brain and existence as you know it will not permit you a quick, painless death. There is no such thing as an instant death. Pain is subjective, controlled by your brain. When you injure yourself, your brain transmits pain to provide you a reason to stop or avoid the injury. The sensation of dying is every nerve, every fiber of your being, being twisted and scorched under the incorrect assumption that transmitting the sensation of pain can cause you to avoid harm. And since the mind controls how you perceive time, death is every nerve and molecule of your being, flayed in perpetuity. Your brain is just a system. If there's a fire, your fire alarm, when triggered, will go off. It responds to stimuli. It will go off even if there's no conceivable possibility that the fire alarm will stop the fire. It just reacts. Your brain will react when you die. Every human being who has ever lived and who has ever died has regretted their life, for the sheer pain of dying blots out everything that came before it. Do not fear me. I am here to help you.
"You speak well,"
she heard herself saying in the dream. It stopped speaking. "Thank you."
"How much of this is real?"
"Nothing of what you are seeing or feeling based on your perceptions is currently real, but everything I am communicating to you is real. She was no longer in the courtyard, but instead in some blank, undistinguished mass of space. The figure was no longer visible, just a charged presence.
Are you a robot or a spirit? Do you have a personality?
It is interesting that you are more interested in me than in what I am communicating to you. My history or story is, cosmically speaking, of no significance. I'm here to help you.
Why should I trust you? And why have you selected me, by the way?
You are perceptive, intelligent, and acutely sensitive enough to allow me entry and to listen to what I have to say. There are hundreds of millions of others who share this quality who, at the right stage of mental or emotional sensitivity, we reach out to save. I can do nothing to prove to you that what I say is true. I cannot interact with you physically. I can only detach your mind and free you.
Well, okay, that's all well and good, but maybe you can come back when I'm older and sick or something? When I'm dying. Despite what you may think, I'm actually relatively happy. I like my friends. I like that I'm still young. Things aren't so bad, even if I act like they are.
I understand. I do not dispute anything you are saying, except there are only limited mental or emotional time periods when you can receive our call. And however much pleasure or fulfillment you extract from your life experience, on net, the transaction will always be a terrible one. If you could do an accounting after your death, my position would be vindicated. Of course, that is not within your power. I just bring to you information. There would be no pain or fear of suicide. It would just be a transition into exactly what you were before you were.
That's interesting. I hope I'm able to receive these messages, say, when I'm old and dying and a burden on my family. I don't have any objection to assisted suicide, given certain circumstances. I think it's a person's right to decide when and how they die.
There was no response. She feared that what she had said sounded small-minded and childish. She always felt that way when expressing political opinions, even though she was fairly confident and adamant about this position. It just seemed misguided, minuscule almost. He was talking about something grander, cosmic. He? Was it a he? More like an it. Finally, it spoke. And if I'm wrong, there's nothing for you to fear. You will be in the same oblivion, absent the pain and ordeal.
I couldn't do that to my family, at the very least. They'd be so sad and upset. It would devastate them.
There was a pause. Everything you are saying is true, given your perspective. And it is the great difficulty in this that you are not privy to the knowledge I possess. That is not your fault, though. It's not within your sphere of understanding. Unfortunately, it is only a truth that can be learned upon death, and upon death, it is a moot point. All I can communicate is this. In death, there is no shared experience. Your family and friends will not endure the experience or the pain for you. These concepts of family and the values you associate with them are nothing in the face of death. They are useful concepts during the course of existence, but disappear as if they never were upon the commencement of your death.
Privy. Privy. That's how the word was pronounced. She was hazily familiar with that word. She'd never pronounced it before and never, she believed, used it in context, but she was confident it had been used correctly. Maybe she had that information tucked away in her subconscious and the dream had dredged it up.
She loved believing the dreams acted as mental sifters, rooting up trivia or a factoid and allowing them to waft gently into the working canals of her conscious brain.
"Tell me a word I don't know, or allow me to speak another language. If I could wake up tomorrow speaking Italian, I'd believe that this was something beyond a normal dream."
Sagacious.
"I know that word, I think. I can't define it, but I associate it with, like, a deer. I don't know why, but I have an association with that word."
She realized her dream was no longer visually interesting. It was just a dark void filled with voices. As if on cue, the figure before her was now an austere, noble-looking white elk, adorned with gleaming antlers that looked like smooth Amazonian vines that had calcified and hardened into sheer bone. Nostomania, an intense homesickness.
Nostomania. Interesting. I like that word. I don't think I know that one. I don't think I've ever heard it. I'm impressed. Just so you know, yes, I am looking that word up immediately when I wake up. So, do you have, like, all the information in the universe? Are you a god? Are you God?
Frigorific, producing cold.
That's a cool one. Frigorific. It sounds like a fake word, like a fake curse. Cold, Homesickness. Cold. Is there a pattern I'm detecting here?
Her palms were sweating. She didn't like that it was complying with her request, whether because it was going to prove itself correct or because she felt she now owed it something she wasn't sure.
"You know, just because you tell me SAT words doesn't mean I'm going to believe you. You know that, right? If you're so wise, you should know that. I do appreciate them, though. I must have read them somewhere and am remembering them now, though. Thanks for telling me about them."
Her sweat accumulated, pooled in her armpits. She was marinating in it. It passed through her insides and poured out forcefully between her legs. She felt its unwelcome presence by her ankles. Even in her dream, she felt inconvenienced, knowing somewhere she was going to wake up to something unpleasant. An inkling of a passing suggestion that the elk was transforming into something else only reinforced the wetness beneath her. She woke up with a start. Right on time, her bladder was close to bursting. She made her way, bow-legged, to the bathroom, making sure to close the door so as not to wake up anyone with the light. It was sad, she thought through fatigued reverie, that the dream was over. There was a hidden world inside her. Worlds and experiences and an imagination that she always coveted but never felt she possessed. But it was there, down below, waiting to be unleashed. A world inside. Assuming, for the sake of argument, that her guest had been real and not just a dream, then its plan had backfired. She was more excited about all the potential that life had to offer than she'd ever been. She liked the interesting presence she'd conjured and looked forward to meeting it again. Still, she wasn't particularly eager to fall asleep again. She blamed it on the heat in the room, but made no attempt to toggle the temperature. And, of course, she looked up those two words, nostomania and frigorific. They were real and had been defined correctly. She was impressed. That was one feeling she could identify. She'd rather not investigate the other feelings. Julia breezed through school the next day. Her classwork was simultaneously more interesting and less interesting. More interesting in the context of how this was part of the wider world beyond her experience, and what lay beyond was so interesting. And less so in that this classwork was, well, classwork, busy work, inconsequential, removed in its way from reality. Questions about, say, trigonometry, were symbols of the deeper world, fascinating in helping her to contemplate an entire universe of theories and connectedness she knew almost nothing about. But this school wasn't the wider world. School was just a holding pen, teenage daycare. She made no mention of her dreams to her friends at lunchtime, except by allusion. Lynn and Julia were both in Miss Shaw's composition class, and Lynn was complaining about the essay Miss Shaw sprung on the class, which she required to be completed over the upcoming weekend.
"Frigorific," Julia replied.
"Frig," Lynn parroted. She liked the hard consonant sound and thought it was a cute word Julia had made up on the spot. It felt appropriate.
"Frigorific, I say! It's frigorific, I say!" Julia continued.
Okay there. No more coffee for you. You've had enough," said Lynn in her understated way. "Or your crack. No more crack for you. Sleeping pills, maybe. Cough drops, sure. Why not? What harm could they do?" She shrugged off her irreverent goofing. Later, when the whole group was together, "So, did anyone have any interesting dreams last night?" Venice, Claire, Lynn, they all drew a blank in their own patented way. Shrugs, noncommittal faces.
"We failed, the whole lot of us," said Lynn. "Thanks for thinking I could even have interesting dreams, though. I have something to aspire to," added Claire.
The downbeat way she said it either made her joke more effective or more harrowing.
"Ven, save us?" pleaded Lynn.
Venice shrugged.
"We used Venn diagrams today in class, and one time I dreamed people were calling out my name, and then I was somehow stuck in a Venn diagram, like I'd become one, because, you know, Venice."
"Got it," Lynn assured her.
"Failure all around."
"So yeah, who knows? Maybe I'll have an interesting dream tonight. But other than that, nah, got nothing," Venice concluded. Julia didn't know what to expect, or if she'd tell her friends anything about her dreams, unless one of them had shared something eerily analogous or equally hyper-specific. The underlying subject of the dreams would be of casual interest, perhaps most so to Lynn, but she didn't feel like entertaining arguments or even discussions about it. This was her thing. She sat on the floor of the dream cave, Indian style, looking up in rapt attention. She knew it was a dream cave because why else would she be in a cave? And why else would the floor appear as nothing more than an inorganic shade of monochromatic light blue? And why else would she be in a cave that had none of the trappings of a cave? No dust, no grime, no darkness even. She could see fine. Everything bathed in a soft, lambent light. There was no indication, even, that anything would be descending from the ceiling. Yet, here she sat, prone and waiting. An immense arachnoid shape descended from the unseen ceiling and appeared before her like an ever-stretching monument in a gilded city. Brobdingnagian, her dream self thought, means marked by tremendous size. It descended patiently but inevitably, like the New Year's ball. She was naturally afraid of spiders, but felt no fear. In dream sleep, she'd learned, the perception of size meant nothing, but even with that knowledge in mind, this was perception-altering. Its carapace and abdomen alone were both leagues taller and wider than her. Each of its eight legs was longer than she, even though there was no reliable form of comparison, for each leg was not actually a leg, but an ethereal projection of a loved friend or family member. Her mother, Venice, Lynn, Claire, a boy named Max she had affection for, her aunt, who she didn't like that much but who was inexplicably present yet again, her first grade teacher, Mrs. Sullivan, forever her favorite teacher, and her dead grandmother, Bernice, all extending outward from the spider's body and wafting like rooted underwater plants. She didn't have the mental bandwidth to recognize and appreciate all 8 projections at once, and she suspected they disappeared, reappeared, and changed their order as she exerted herself in making sense of them. Her grandmother in particular was unusual, in that Julia had no working memory of what she looked like when she was alive. She died when Julia was only 5. While the other legs were fluid and dynamic, like ghostly projections, her grandmother's was rigid and flat, a brown wall projected behind it. She recognized the image. It was a picture of her grandmother that her mother kept on her nightstand. As she looked at the projection, she felt herself inhabit that old space, the musty smell of mothballs and unsavory hard candies, the brown wall cut with 3 shelves of knickknacks. She could tell the shelves were occupied, but had no idea with what. The spider lowered to her level. Its carapace was beautiful and sleek, metallic, appropriate for the antiseptic crystal space. She didn't fear it. She gasped as it flexed its legs, saw the projections of her loved ones adjust, images changing their aspect ratio. "I've been dreaming about you," she said, a line that was funny and ridiculous even to herself. "I'm afraid of spiders, but your appearance is different. If this is my mind trying to make me afraid of you, it backfired." The spider lacked the mandibles, the grubby, crawly sense of alien otherness that made people itch and slap at themselves in disgust. This was more like a crystalline spider ornament, an aesthetic monument to their ability to captivate. It had not yet spoken to her. "I'm glad you returned," she offered. "Yes, I am glad you do not fear me. Your subconscious mind recognizes what I represent on some level, so it will always inspire you to fear me. I want you to show me. I don't know how to say it, if there is a proper way to say it. I want to follow you wherever you're willing to lead me. I want you to show me." The enormous crystal spider shape hung motionless. Its 8 projected legs continued shimmering. She noted in a microsecond passing that the legs lost focus and blurred whenever she focused on expressing herself. "I am happy to hear that. But I must tell you, I must make you understand, I am not here to show you anything. You will not be seeing anything. This is not an adventure I'm taking you on. Your brain repels me and makes you fear me, because it wants to survive to reproduce itself and its genetics, despite the personal cost to you. But part of the nature of your brain, your very being, is influenced by what you've experienced. Your culture prioritizes adventures, journeys of discovery. You think this is what is expected of you on some level. This is not a journey of discovery or self-knowledge. This is not a journey where you will learn about yourself. This is the end of your existence. I am offering you only the escape from the inevitable experience that awaits you, the most excruciating agony that awaits you. That is all."
"I understand," she said.
"I don't believe that, but I can only work with what is. In this dream, this image you have created, you are staring up at me in awe. The size differential is influencing your decision-making, making you genuflect before me. I do not want you to be unduly influenced. Your type submits and becomes obedient to differences in height and perceived dominion, and I do not want that coloring your decision. But perhaps it is inevitable."
"I understand. Thank you. I have made up my mind. I want to follow you. I want to go with you. I trust you. I'm excited, and I'm curious."
There was no way to calculate time in dream sleep, she knew. A narrative sequence spanning years in dream sleep can occur in the objective length of a second. Yet still, even knowing that, she felt time passing and passing without a response from the great figure before her. Finally, after what felt like hours, it spoke. "I am certain that you are making the correct decision, although perhaps not for the right reason. I am certain that, if you could live out your entire uninterrupted life, experience the agony of natural death, and then situate yourself in this position again, you would understand why this choice was the correct one. My hesitation, which you may suspect, is because I want to make sure you are making an informed decision. Even if it is a correct decision, it is my obligation to ensure you are making an informed decision. If you agree to this, this is the end of your existence. I want you to understand that this is the end of your existence if you follow me." She nodded slowly. There was a rumbling excitement within her, an eruption of elation, of grand virgin vistas. Her nerves flared up in panic, but she suppressed it, pushed through it, and smothered it. There was again a long delay. "I am confident you are making the right decision." She closed her eyes. Inside the dream, she thought, as her eyes were already closed in the real world, and allowed her guardian to lead her into the dark of her mind and into the dark of the void. If this were real, it would be amazing. If it were just a dream, she'd wake up and have more fantastic dreams to dream. Claire sat in English class. This was a senior class, late in the period and late in the school year. In essence, this class would have no bearing whatsoever on her or her colleagues' academic futures, and they acted accordingly. The class, separated into five distinct groups of about four or five students each, spent a couple of conspicuous seconds of conversation on the assignment at hand, and then shifted to talk about practically anything else. Claire trailed off and forgot what she was talking about. Henry, a casual friend and classmate, kept his head arched, ready to nod and be understanding. Henry was a nice, calm, Chinese-American student who planned on attending the University of Binghamton, as did she, and as did a fair portion of her graduating class. Since they would both soon be attending the same college, she figured it'd be helpful to get to know him better, since she may be seeing him around campus next year. I totally blanked on what I was saying. "You were?" He paused, hoping that maybe she'd remember on her own accord. "You were talking about Julia's..."
"Funeral, right! Julia's funeral! Oh my God, I can't believe I forgot that! That's so weird."
Claire had tracked every day since Julia's passing and did not want to contemplate a time when she didn't keep up those efforts. There was a high-pitched female laughter beside them, the "oh my God" kind, that jolted her like a next-door gunshot.
"Anyway, any big plans this summer? Are you going to Corey's party by the lake this weekend?"
The end of senior year was a democratizing season, with a built-in reference point for different cliques and groups to hang out. She wrote "Wuthering Heights, Reasons" on her notebook in big, bold letters, in case Ms. Harrison walked around checking on them. She crossed out "reasons" and didn't know why she wrote it down to begin with. She breathed heavily and looked back up at Henry. He was gone. His chair was moved back a space, as if he'd made room to get up and leave. She looked around to see where he went and didn't see him or the classroom door closing or anything to suggest he'd left the room or had even ever been in the room. She looked over in Venice's direction to make sympathetic eye contact, a general "get me out of here" face, and wondered why not just walk over there. It's already pandemonium in here. No one's paying attention. She never got Venice's attention. Beyond Lies the Wub puts the wub in Wuthering Heights. It's about a pig, said Suzanne, a classmate in her study group. Did anyone else find it so creepy when the pig's head is on, like, a platter and is still talking to the main character? That freaked me out. That picture freaked me out.
That didn't make any sense, but okay.
Claire was nodding slowly and empathizing.
I remember I read this story once when I was in, like, in junior high, in a collection called Beyond Lies the Wub. I thought it had something to do with Wuthering Heights for some reason, or maybe it was the same thing. I didn't know. All the stories were illustrated, and all I remember about that story was that there was, like, a detailed picture of a hog's, like, decapitated head. It scared the shit out of me. It's so funny you mentioned that.
She turned to Suzanne, who was wearing Henry's face, stitched atop her own. It didn't fit over her face properly. Had anyone told her that? The incongruity of Suzanne's lush blonde waves over Henry's inscrutable, dried-out face was too much for her. She almost laughed, but contained herself. How did Suzanne speak so clearly while wearing Henry's face like that? Crinkly holes were carved for her eyes, but not the mouth, which retained Henry's usual blasé expression. Suzanne raised her hand, didn't receive any response, and walked up and left the class, bringing what remained of Henry along with her. She imagined Suzanne in the bathroom, employing lotions in vain to get that crinkly skin mask looking smoothed out. Julia was sitting in front of her in Suzanne's seat. Julia was here. Adrenaline surged inside her, sending everything around her into a whirling paroxysm, like a violently tossed fishbowl. Julia was still there when her vision stabilized. Julia, this couldn't be. This was a dream. The surge of emotion made her perspire, and the whole classroom heated up uncomfortably. She felt herself with her hand and felt a down black puff jacket. That's why it was so hot. She thought to take it off, but didn't.
Julia? What are you doing here?
Julia looked like she always had, she sensed. A dim outline of her mottled brown hair, rounded, moonish pale face, the brown dots of freckles and the red clusters of stubborn zits. Claire identified that pimple. It was a nasty one she'd noticed on Julia the last day she'd ever seen her alive.
A lot of juice is coming out of it, Julia had complained. But at least it's apple juice, she'd joked.
The memory of that quip reverberated on the school's loudspeaker so everyone could hear it and smile and laugh. The pimple expanded into its own world, lifting Claire out into the galaxy when it ruptured, and she slid down the expulsion of pus like a toddler on a toboggan.
I miss you, Julia, she said despite herself.
She didn't have a lisp when she spoke, she noted, again despite herself. She didn't care about that. She knew what this was. This was a dream.
Where's Isaac? Why isn't he waking me up?
She pushed herself to flail her arms to force herself awake, but she remained in the dream.
I know you aren't real, Julia. I know this is a dream.
I'm not trying to make you believe this is anything but a dream, the voice spoke to her. She knew that voice.
It had been the voice that visited her innumerable times, even in her daydreams, whenever her conscious mind wavered. The voice had always remained patient, understanding, and reassuring. It had explained all about the nature of pain and how Julia, wisely, after deep consideration, chose to unmake herself rather than await the indescribable agony that awaits us all. It spoke about how Julia one day just no longer was, and how this was a decision of her own making. Don't feel bad for her. Envy her. Julia had passed in her sleep without medical explanation. No furtive drug habit, no shocking heart attack or brain aneurysm, no unknown allergy, nothing glorious, poetic, or valiant. Not even something gory or tragic, but at least understandable. Something for which an emotion could be attached and understanding processed, other than whatever emotion or understanding lurked in the aghast, torn space Claire felt in the pit of her stomach. Confusion, dread, bewilderment. The space was the cousin of anxiety, churned the way anxiety does, sent its tendrils throughout her system the way anxiety does. But it was not anxiety, just the absence of something.
"I hate you," she said to the voice, even though she didn't really mean that and was just speaking stupidly. "I hate you. You took her from us. If what you're saying is true, you took her from us. She was my best friend. She had a family who loved her. Did you know that? And now she's gone." She'd had this conversation so many times and already been through the range of emotions. She reached her hands out to hug Julia's neck. Julia's head tipped forward and fell hard to the floor like heavy luggage, though it made no sound. Roaches and black bugs crawled from the impossibly proportioned spigot that was Julia's neck. Claire screamed without sound, averted her eyes and closed her palms. There were no bugs. Julia was sitting there again, head and all, undisturbed. "You know that does not make sense. That is your brain trying to scare you off, trying to upset you. It is reaching for the horrific, what it thinks will scare you, disgust you. You know this." She looked back at Julia, which she knew was where the voice emanated from. Claire had been through denial, been upset, furious, depressed, overwhelmed, and even at times felt contented and felt something like acceptance. If what the voice told her was true, then Julia was in a better place. Non-existence. She'd avoided the pain of natural death, the voice assured her. No one who loves anyone would permit them to experience a natural death. Having her alive for her company while subjecting her to the possibility of a natural death was, in a sense, selfish. Claire didn't really believe any of that, not really, but it was a nice thought. To think her friend had made her own choice, made what could be the correct choice, that her choice created meaning and understanding to fill, or at least create the semblance of something that could fill, that pit in her stomach. "If it's good enough for her, well, it's good enough for me," Claire said to the voice, in a half space of resignation. She said it just to say it, almost as if on a dare. The paroxysms, the violent distortion of adrenaline-soaked anxiety, tore at the fabric of her dream for a moment. Julia had been lucky, the voice explained. The vast majority of people were on a different mental wavelength and could not receive these overtures. In a sense, then, she was lucky too, since here she was. "I mean it,"
she doubled down her provocation.
"I do not believe you mean that. As much as I think it would be in your best interest to believe it, I'm not sure you do."
"No, I do. I've had enough of this. I've had enough of this wondering."
Her voice sounded faintly contemptuous, even to herself. If she was awake, she'd be sitting cross-armed, curled into herself, steaming in a little tantrum, thinking, "Fuck everybody else. I want to experience what she experienced. I want to know."
"You do not understand. There is nothing to experience. I offer you the absence of experience. What you will eventually experience otherwise is the unendurable, never-ending pain of your own natural death."
"I don't want to talk anymore."
There was an edge in Claire's voice, even though this was nothing but a dream.
"I believe you. I've met and spoken with you so many times. I believe. I accept. You wouldn't be so persistent unless you were real. You wouldn't know what you know unless this was real. Otherwise, this is just all fake. My crazy imagination.
in which case I'll just wake up. So here I am. If what you're saying is true, then I believe. Take me with you. She extended her hand and struck a pose of concentration and acceptance. I grant you permission, every permission you need. I believe you. I believe. My brain, my impulses are hardwired in the interest of the species' survival, but not my personal interest. See? I understand. I believe. I accept, okay? I accept. She extended her hand more forcefully, her look now of determination. Julia took her hand and held her close. There was no classroom, just them, outside, in space. This space is the pit in your soul, the emptiness you feel, Claire felt, and panicked. She had buyer's remorse before the thought was even expressed. Wake up! Where's Isaac? Piss yourself, shit yourself, wake yourself up! Isaac, where are you? I told you to protect me! She had been impulsive and didn't want this anymore. She pulled back, and before even running was an option, she was already making her way toward the door of the classroom. Claire turned around and saw a Julia of distended limbs and joints launching toward her. Claire was trapped between her limbs now, encaged underneath them, and Julia's goopy neck cascaded down in front of her. Her head flipped back, upside down, revealing her face of ridged teeth. No. Embrace this.
I want to be awake! Isaac, where are you?
You granted me permission. You made the right decision. Shut off what your brain is telling you. There's nothing to fear. A distended limb ending in the shape of a sharpened asterisk shot out and held her arm. She was trapped between stalk-like growths. The only exit was occupied by Julia's distorted death face. A force gripped her throat, and soft pads closed over her larynx. There is nothing to fear. There's nothing to fear. Her mind was not assuaged. Every cell in her body revolted, flush with hot terror.
Isaac, where are you?
There is nothing to fear, said the fearsome face, a cacophony of sharp, threatening sights, repugnant smells, and unsettling, booming explosions. There is nothing to fear. Your mind has not realized it has lost. You are free from it. There's nothing to fear. This is just your conscious mind's last spasms. This is nothing compared to what you'd experience upon your natural death. All was nothing. Venice pulled into the parking lot of the small shopping courtyard that contained JV Hot Bagels. It was 8:30 a.m. on a Saturday in December. Other than the post office, JV Hot Bagels was the only business she recognized. She'd only been upstate in college at Albany for a year and a half, and truth be told, she'd never been super observant. But only recognizing two stores was something. A sign. A good sign? A bad sign? Maybe a sign that this place was behind her. She didn't know. It just felt like something. Like moving on. It was winter. Lakewood High School was not in session, so it wasn't surprising JV Hot Bagels was empty. The only other customer, a mustached, overweight, middle-aged man in a New York Giants beanie, gathered his brown bag and gave her the look-over, as most men did. She was inured to it, didn't bother her except when she knew the middle-aged man in question, like if it was a friend's father. She didn't know this guy, so what? Kinda icky, but whatever. She was taller than him, and liked being taller than most men. The door opened, she heard the little bell, and he left without incident. She ordered what she had always ordered when she was just another high school regular. Pumpernickel bagel, toasted, vegetable cream cheese, and a coffee, light on the milk and sugar. She was serviced by the owner, who recognized her, and she made small talk with him. He was a nice guy, late 30s, gelled hair and muscular, attractive in a typical way. Rumor was he slept with a couple of the girls who worked here, but for all she knew, those were just rumors. And whatever, it's a free country. She told him about what she was majoring in. Undecided, she said with a smile, but leaning toward double majoring in business and sociology. And he said something about that being impressive and ambitious, as if college wasn't just a bullshit way station between childhood and adulthood. She made small talk about how she liked Albany and got along with her roommates. Yeah, she'd gotten lucky on that end. And how the school lived up to its reputation as a party school.
I bet, he said,
which he'd certainly said 100 times before. She took her brown paper bag and said her goodbyes. She decided to eat outside, despite the dry cold. Nostalgia required a cold environment, she thought. It wouldn't feel right in a place like Florida, where the warm weather is beckoning and life-affirming. Nostalgia warms you up in a certain way. It requires gray cold and hot coffee and local restaurants and blue Giants beanies. She could see the edge of the high school from here. She looked at the high school and reminisced without active thoughts, just about her time there, her friends. There were no real feelings to unearth. It's not like anything was buried here. No dramatic emotions, just the sad reminders of loss. Lynn would be back in town next week from RIT, which Venice was deeply looking forward to. As college went on, they'd seen each other less, but for valid, expected reasons. Their respective schools were a solid 3.5 hours away from each other. They'd made their own separate friends, and Lynn was an engineering major, so she actually had to study during the school year, especially come finals time. Venice hadn't seen Lynn in about 6 weeks, actually. There's that obligatory gravitas about being back in town, but hopefully they could enjoy their free time together without too much painful reminiscing, and hopefully each year onward would get easier and easier. She put the 2 hot coffee in the drink holder, started the car with her right hand, and snacked on the still hot bagel. She pulled out of the parking lot and thought about pulling up to Lakewood, but didn't. That would be too sentimental, and she really wasn't that type of person. Just thinking about pulling up to her old high school was enough. She drove down the main road and passed the turnoff for Mohegan Lake. She stayed in the right lane, even though everyone rushed into the left turn only lane just to cut everyone else off at the light. It didn't bother her. Everyone in town knew about this annoying light and this annoying behavior. It was kind of unifying. She was multitasking, driving, texting, eating, furtively finger-checking on her coffee cup to see if it was drinkable yet. She should have grabbed a coffee sleeve. She was about 10 minutes away from her parents' home off Curry Street. She had a boatload of movies and television shows to catch up on, a ton of extra coffee to drink at home, and absolutely jack shit else to do. Ah, to be home. She got a hearty scallion chunk in the last bite. That was good. Her phone vibrated. It was jammed right against her coffee. She clamped down on the coffee lid to prevent any from spilling over. She checked the message. Brenda, a friend from college who lived in her dorm. Usual gripes about being back home. Emoticons and empathy. Continued buzzing vibrations, the red flashing light of her phone out of the corner of her eye. Crumpled bag, smeared on its edges with cream cheese. The phone between her legs at a traffic light. A long, hopefully final text until she got home. The coffee was good. She was glad he put in too much sugar. Starting on the second half of the bagel. Car engine kicked a little bit, some pullback, whatever. Rushing to make the right on the yellow light. Another insectile buzz from her phone. She checked to see who it was from, turning to make the light, ignoring the uncomfortable sting of the coffee that now dotted her hand. Turning That oncoming SUV was retarded. Fucker should stop and wait for her. It didn't. Nausea overtook her. No, that wasn't right. A moment of dreadful anticipation. A pivot point that lasted a millennium. The SUV plowed head-on into her Kia. The metal mousetrap of her surroundings ruptured and exploded, roaring, folding into itself, a ship collapse in perpetuity. Coroner's report. She died instantly. Roland, 6 years old, didn't want to go see Grandma Linny. He didn't like the way she looked and the way she smelled. He hadn't seen her for almost 2 months, ever since she had gotten sick and been in the hospital. He visited her in the hospital once and didn't like it. He didn't say anything about it, just kept to himself and didn't talk. Grandma was nice and usually gave him toys or gifts, and if she did something he didn't understand, his mom and dad would always let him know she did something nice by saying, "Oh, isn't that nice?" And he'd feel comfortable about it. He was going to visit Linny in the hospital. He was dressed in a dark suit and tie that everyone said was so cute and charming, but was a little itchy, and he didn't like everyone watching over him. He went with Mom, Dad, and his older brother, Kale, who was 10. Kale was acting like the big boy and telling Roland to be on his best behavior. Roland already planned on being good, and even letting Grandma pat him on the head and kiss him. It took them a long time to get to the hospital. Roland liked looking out the windows. He liked cars, was fascinated by them. Grandma Linny grew up near New York City, a place he'd never been, but he knew there were brightly colored taxis there. The most famous were the bright yellow taxis, Grandma told him. Then there were also bright lime green taxis, she told him, that went to the less crowded areas. And now, there were bright purple and bright red taxis, too. And there were trains that went underground, where all different kinds of people rode together. He wanted to visit New York and see the taxis and the trains, and see the big, famous toy stores and candy shops and eat ice cream. He lived in Delaware, and he didn't know why that was funny, but he heard people saying Delaware was funny and, "No New York." When he got older, he'd go to New York City. His aunt and uncle and relatives lived somewhere in New York, on an island. But not a fun island. An island that looked a lot like his town, except maybe more crowded. They were going to meet them at the hospital, too. They all crowded into the hospital room. Roland played by counting them all. One, himself. Two, his brother Kale. 3 and 4, Mom and Dad. 5, Grandma, who was Mom's mom. But maybe she didn't count? Okay, then 5, Aunt Josie, Mom's sister. And 6, her husband William. 7, 8, 9, Josie's children, Auden, Alden, and August. All in this one room. He was the youngest, and everyone paid attention to him, but he liked to stay quiet. His Grandma Linny seemed very tired. She always seemed sort of tired, and one time he said she should get more sleep, and she said something, and everyone laughed. But now she looked really bad, really thin, and her eyes were dark-colored. She just didn't look good, and he didn't want to tell anyone, but he was scared she would get him sick. He was brought over to hug and kiss Grandma Linny. He felt bad that he was scared to hug her, and he felt bad that she must have realized that. "Kiss your Grandma Linny," his mother said. "Linny loves you, and you love Linny, don't you?" He did love Linny, and he didn't mean to be scared. He knew she wasn't well. She was old. She was in her 80s, which was an impossible idea. He wasn't even in his 10s yet. She had been alive 8 times as long as his brother, which was amazing. He'd said it was amazing once, and everyone laughed. That laugh he'd liked. He knew that Grandma Linny was special. She'd been a successful engineer. He wasn't sure what that was, but it was hard to do and you had to be smart for it and read a lot. Plus, engineers worked on trains and helped build cars, although she was not that kind of engineer. Plus, Grandma Linny made Mom, and Mom made him. He hugged Grandma Linny and ignored the musky smell that reminded him of his dog when she was wet and sick. Linny was covered in a smooth plastic sheet, kind of like the way his toys came wrapped. This sheet helped to keep her well. She had fallen recently and hurt herself and gotten really weak. He didn't know much about it, but she was sick inside. He knew that things disappeared when they died, and that Linny would probably disappear soon.
"I love you, Ro-Ro. You're going to go on a boat someday, and you promised to say Ro-Ro for me?"
He nodded into her shoulder. He'd already been on a boat. People had asked him to do that, and he'd done it, but he'd do it again. He had never gone on a boat by himself, so he could make that promise to do it by himself one day. She kissed him on his head, but it didn't feel like lips on his head. It felt like a pencil eraser. It was so rough. He didn't say anything. He thought they would spend a short time there and leave, but they stayed for a long time. At some point later in the day, his dad and uncle came over together with some of the other kids and asked him if he wanted to go to a toy store for a little bit. Mom and Aunt were going to stay behind. He wanted to be a good big boy and stay with Grandma Linny. He felt it would be a good thing to do, but they insisted and he said okay. They tried to excite him by saying he could get anything he wanted, and that was exciting, but he didn't know how to feel about it and stayed subdued. It would be the last time he saw Grandma Linny. Few could be this lucky. Her husband had not been so lucky. Her dear, beloved Anthony passed 6 years ago now, a heart attack. He passed with no one around.
"I'll be joining you soon, my dear," Lynn told herself.
She was surrounded by her daughters, her beautiful daughters, the lights of her life. Her large, loving family, her gifts and testament to this world. She held hands and kissed and embraced. At her age, death was a constant. Even as a child, she remembered, death took her three dearest friends. Two of them, bizarre freak occurrences. How else to explain two young girls dying in their sleep? Julia and Claire. She remembered them. Claire. Quiet, clever Claire. So clever, so quiet, so reserved. Smarter than she'd let on. Didn't talk much because of her lisp, she remembered. But still, the first of the group to have a real boyfriend. And Julia. Sweet Julia. It pained her that she couldn't remember much about Julia, other than that she had passed first. Venice, her other young friend, was in a terrible car accident a couple years later, while she was home from college. How tragic. Venice, such a beauty, such a beautiful name, such a beautiful girl. So tragic, so terrible. She remembered a period of consoling dreams she had, where she told herself that Julia and Claire had died peacefully, painlessly. She'd been asked, crazily, to join them, but no, she wanted none of that. She'd been scared of death then, as was to be expected as a teenager. She wasn't so afraid anymore. She'd lived her time. She'd lived a good life.
"Well, girls, I'll be joining you."
And joining all her other dear friends who'd taken the next step in the adventure. She hoped she'd join them as teenagers, or else they could greet her as adults of advanced age, as if they hadn't been taken so abruptly. Voices now sounded like she was underwater. Her daughters were sobbing, clutching each other, trying to be strong but failing. They consoled each other. They spoke as if she'd already passed.
"I'm still here, you silly dearies," she thought.
But perhaps not. Perhaps this was passing gracefully. She thanked God for painkillers and all the sweet doctors and nurses helping her. Such nice people. All the nice people throughout her life. All the fullness she'd enjoyed when others had been taken so tragically. She drifted off. She lived 82 years on Earth. Between the synapses of her dying brain, she'd live a millennium in agony. Beneath the sedatives, she felt a disruption. Placid, warm, comforting water boiling in an instant. Hey, bolever saman, she thought insanely. A word she didn't remember ever hearing. No, hearing in a dream. One of those crazy dreams from her youth that now came back to her with its full wretched meaning intact. That's how she'd described death to herself in a dream, after her friend's own deaths. But that was stupid crazy talk from so long ago. Help me! Help me! Dear God, help me! She reached out, pinioned herself, clamoring against the wall of oblivion encasing her. God, help me! Help me! Help me! She screamed for her family. Fuck you, you ungrateful pieces of shit! You worthless bitches! Help me! Help me! She reached out in vain, but nothing was moving. Every fiber of her being pinpricked, aflame, virulent, eyes gouged out, everything organic and important gouged out. Kill the children! Kill the children! She screamed against the perpetual, all-consuming pain that all men and women experience upon the precipice of death. The pain that causes them to forsake their loved ones and their lives' work for even just the barest chance of reprieve. Take Kale! Take Roland! Take Auden! And as if this knowledge had always been there, as if she had always known who she'd sacrifice first to make the galaxy of pain crest. She wanted to feel the sensation, tear Roland asunder, wrench him with her hands, to transfer the bilious suffering from her to the form of another. She'd tear Roland in two with her bare hands to make this stop. She'd squeeze him until he exploded, rive him into stumps and pieces. Anyone, please, God, oh God, please, anyone else. Oh God, please, please, please. This can't be right. This can't be it. A flooding of experience and pain commanding her to escape, to flee death. But it's impossible. She's an animal being cooked over a flame, with every fiber of her being broadcasting the pain as an incentive to remove the spit. A lobster in boiling water with a pot jammed closed. Oh God, oh God, oh God! And even that's what she intended to think, but it was nonsense. Gibberish. The drugs did nothing. There was agony under the fog. Gibbering, incessant liquids of acid and organs of twisting thorn. God! God! A scream that renders throats a pulping mess. All her years spent on Earth resulting in a perpetuity in a boiling fishbowl. Help me! Help me! Oh, help me! Fuck you for doing this to me! Fuck you! Fuck you! Please, God, help me! Fuck you! Fuck you! Do something! Help me! Please, God! Anyone! Please, God! Anyone! With great sympathy, the doctor consoled the grieving kin. It's the best anyone could hope for. She was well-loved, well-cared for, heavily sedated. She went peacefully. And yes, yes, thank God for that. You've been listening to Vernichtungsschmerz by J.R. Hamantaschen. J.R. Hamantaschen is a writer of short stories, having released several collections, including a deep horror that was very nearly awe, with a voice that is often still confused but is becoming ever louder and clearer, and "You shall never know security." JR also co-hosts a horror podcast called The Horror of Nachos and Hamantaschen. Well, listeners, that's quite a way to end our show tonight. I know that a great many of our stories end with less than favorable outcomes for their protagonists, but this one in particular is going to stick with me. As you lay in bed tonight, letting your body relax and your mind drift towards sleep, I'd recommend doing your best to not entertain the reality posited by tonight's tale. I'd like to thank J.R. Hamantaschen for letting us feature his story tonight, and for essentially ripping the fucking guts out of my own sense of security for the rest of my life. You can find more of J.R.'s stories over at VelixBooks.com, along with a wide selection of other independent horror. That's VelixBooks.com. In more uplifting news, I'd like to remind you all that the wait is nearly over. Next week, on August 3rd, we will begin our closing out of Season 8 of Horror Hill by cracking open The Events at Porath Farm by Ted Klein. By this point, you're probably all sick of me hyping up this event, but I think that, after you hear it, you'll absolutely understand why I've been so excited about sharing it with you all. This will be a two-parter, finishing up on August 10th, and then we'll be rolling right into Season 9. Until next time, listeners, stay spooky. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to me. If you'd like to hear a premium, ad-free edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, including past episodes of this program, all of our other shows, and hundreds of standalone releases, all of them ad-free and available to download or stream. Thanks so much for your time and for giving our sponsors a try today. When you support our sponsors, you help support this show, and that means a lot to me. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. As for me personally, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, username Viking Guitar, and also on Instagram as Viking Guitar Productions. In particular, if you're looking for someone to provide voice work for your own project, or are in need of audio production of any sort, it would be wonderful to chat. Until next week, listener, when we meet up once again atop the Horror Hill for yet another dance with darkness, I bid you good night. Sleep tight, listener, and if you hear scratching at your door, don't open it. The darkness may have found you, but it's up to you to let it in. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs.
Tonight's episode was hosted by, and its featured tale performed by, yours truly, Eric Peabody. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Nikki McSorley and Eric Peabody. Finalization by Craig Groshek and S.K. Brown. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to us today at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, please subscribe to us to make sure you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on social media to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and our other programs. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every week. And don't forget to hit the thumbs up button to let us know how we're doing and leave us a kind comment. Lastly, don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archives and ad-free downloads of all of your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, you can hear more of my work on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights podcast. However, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.